everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on antique firearms when we come back. You know, many of the lessons that you hear on this Law Hour program are just a small part of my two-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure. And this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, and write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn all of them here at the law school in this class. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about antique firearms. Let me bring you up to speed. There are 9 classes of persons who are prohibited from having firearms. Well, at least here in the United States. Those 9 classes are fugitives, mental defectives, illegal aliens, users of drugs or marijuana, those who have renounced their citizenship, former military personnel with dishonorable discharges, persons subject to domestic restraining orders, persons convicted of misdemeanor domestic crimes of violence, such as threatening your wife 20 years ago can be enough, persons who have been convicted of a crime potentially punishable by more than a year in prison, a bad check conviction from 40 years ago could suffice for that. These 9 categories or classifications are prohibited from keeping and bearing arms. And of course, people look at that and they say, well, we have a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. That's true. Now, let's take a look at what is it that government is regulating with these 25,000? And there are about 25,000 of these regulations and gun laws that are in or on the books today. And the answer to that is that government is not regulating your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Government is regulating Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8. Now, if you take a look at the Commerce Clause, Congress has the power to enact laws to regulate commerce in any way that they desire. So, in reality, the Second Amendment is not even the issue. I get calls here constantly from people that are complaining about government regulation over guns, and I'm sitting here saying, well, they're not regulating guns in any different way than they're regulating automobiles, and you have a constitutional right to travel. You just don't have a constitutional right to travel in commerce. So if you're going to use commerce, which is the airlines, the bus lines, the train lines, and the shipping lines, Congress can regulate and control that. So when you go into an airport and they say, well, bend over, we're going to look up your rectum, and or we're going to search you, or we're going to do this, that, or something else. Nobody's regulating your right to travel. They're regulating your right to travel in a commercial mode on an airliner. That's always been in our Constitution, and the fact that they didn't do that in 1950, 60, or 70 doesn't mean that they couldn't have. Government's always had that power. It's just that they didn't exercise that power. All right, so now it hasn't changed our constitutional rights in any way. And the same thing is true with guns. You have a constitutional right to a gun. Even these nine classifications of persons still have their same constitutional rights to a gun. What's being regulated is their access to guns in commerce. And I pointed that out to you here with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The court ruled that there was neither a transfer nor a sale of the weapons or their parts. So Congress did not have the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate homemade guns crafted from scratch. So here's a guy, remember, that he made a gun in his basement, and he was a felon. And so they arrested him and said, well, first of all, you've got a fully automatic machine gun. That's against the law. And secondly, you're a convicted felon. So now we're going to prosecute you on these two charges. Well, Ninth Circuit comes in and says, yeah, but wait a minute. This guy has a constitutional right under the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. And you can't regulate and control a fully automatic machine gun. So you've got a right to do it under the Second Amendment, but you don't have a right to do it in commerce. And so what most people are doing, they go out and they buy an Uzi submachine gun, which is a corporate-made gun. So I showed you in Hale versus Hinkle. Hale versus Hinkle. Remember, 1905. Congress can regulate corporations to the nth degree. And so what's happening here, you join commerce. You go out and buy an automobile, a Ford, or a Chevrolet. That's made in commerce. It's regulated under commerce. The fact that you bought it makes you a partner with General Motors or Ford. And it's regulated and controlled. It's the government's car. Same thing is true with guns. When our Constitution was created back in 1787, you went to a gunsmith and he made you a gun. That was property and a property right. Now, you don't go to a gunsmith, you go to a corporation, and under Hale versus Hinkle, the corporation is regulated, you become a partner of Winchester or Remington. Ah, but there's an exception here. Antique firearms, guns made prior to 1899, that is, guns up through 1898, are antiques, and they're not regulated. They're not regulated under the Commerce Clause. So let's take a look at this. Between 1858 and 1898, millions of cartridge-firing guns were made by gun manufacturers like Smith & Wesson, Colt, Ivor Johnson, and Remington, in calibers like .22 or .32, .38, .44, .45, and dozens of others. Now, believe it or not, these original guns are not only so abundant that they can be purchased for $150 or less at virtually any American gun show. They're totally exempt from federal gun control regulations. And at most gun shows, you can find very workable .32 or .38 Smith & Wesson revolvers, 12-gauge double-barrel shotguns, 7mm German Mauser bolt-action military rifles, and many other firearms for less than $150. All of these guns made prior to 1899, and they're legal for anyone, even prohibited persons, to possess. All right, now did you get that? Cartridge firing guns. Now, we're going to cover that a little later, and there's a problem with ammunition because the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms regulates not just the guns, but also the ammunition that goes in them. So let's suppose you go out here and you buy one of these antique Smith & Wesson 1880 38 caliber revolvers, and then you run down and you buy some new smokeless powder from Federal or somebody's Western, some ammunition manufacturing company. Now you're in violation of the law again. And the trick to all of this is that you have to obey, you have to practice all the laws of the United States, all the laws of your state, and all the laws of Moses, and do it all at the same time. That's the trick to it. Now, God never gave you any gun control or weapons control regulations. The theory behind the common law is that everybody is responsible under the strict liability doctrine for all of his own actions. In modern America, you're not responsible for all of your actions, and because of that, you have to be regulated and controlled. When I was a kid, my dad taught me how to use a gun. Today, we don't do that. Parents do not train or teach their children gun safety or how to use a gun. At least I haven't seen very much of that going on. I imagine there's a few odd cases, but as a general rule, we don't. As evidenced by the fact that we have school shootings, drive-by shootings. You have teen-age gangs. You know, if I'd have come home and said, well, I belong to this gang, my dad would have just beat me up one side and down the other. What do you mean you belong to a gang? I didn't act outside of my parents' permission. Today, kids, they just run around like weeds, and they drive down the streets. I was in Phoenix, Arizona some years back, and I was absolutely amazed. In 16 days, there were 14 drive-by shootings in 16 days, nearly one a day, reported in the local paper. I called home. I said, Dirk, have you been reading about all these drive-by shootings in Phoenix, Arizona? He said, no, never heard a word about it. It's so common in these big cities for people to just drive down the street and shoot people on the street corners that they don't even report it in the national press. Well, that's America for you, see? When I talk about gun violence here, it's not the guns that's having a problem. It's the people that are unable to control them. People in America can't control their drinking, as evidenced by these young people on spring break. As evidenced by the fact that people are not taught to drink in this country, not taught how to drink and how to control alcoholic beverages. We're a nation of incompetence. We rely upon OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commission and these various government agencies to guide and direct our actions because we're not able to control ourselves. And so we have to have doctors to control our health problems and lawyers to control our legal actions and problems. And we have highway patrolmen to guide and direct our driving on the highways. I mean, we obviously can't handle this by ourselves. We used to. Americans used to be a pretty competent nation of people, but today we're not. And I think that's partly caused by public school. But it hasn't changed our Constitution any. All of the rights, privileges, and immunities that you had in 1787, you still have today in 2005. There's no problem there. BATF is not regulating or controlling your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and yet I get calls in here and emails and letters, and people are complaining about, they call Michigan, you know, the People's Republic of Michigan, or the People's Republic of California, and so on. There's no change in the law insofar as our Constitution's concerned. There's a big change in the law as your relationship personally to government is concerned. People today commonly have marriage licenses, business licenses, driver's licenses, social security. They have aid to families with dependent children and food stamps and the WIC program or farm price subsidies and so on and on. It's just never ending. All of these government programs and all these bureaucracies over here regulating and controlling people who can't make a living on their own and have to go to government to have that living subsidized. They can't marry without the government guiding and controlling their marriage. They can't conduct private business, so they have to conduct public business with government regulation and controls. That's why we have the IRS and business licenses and so on. We've created a guardian ward relationship here in America between individuals and the government. And then complain when our guardians come out to regulate us in these voluntary activities. Nobody puts a gun to your head and says, go down and get a business license. And yet, all of you people that are in business went down, got a business license, and then complained about OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commission and sales tax and on it goes. I know, I did the same thing. I had a corporation out in Idaho. Atlantis Manufacturing Company. Went down. Nobody put a gun to my head. I went to my attorney and said, what should I do? He drew up the papers and said, sign here, and I did. And then I just complained bitterly about all of these government regulators coming in here and telling me how to operate my business. It wasn't my business. It was the state of Idaho's business, and I was their agent. I didn't know that. I didn't understand business. I thought I did. I'd been to public school. I was 40 years old. I thought I understood banks and banking and checks and checking. And I didn't. I didn't know how that worked. I didn't understand the law. Then one day I was talking to a judge, and his name was Judge Schmidt. As a matter of fact, I was in his chambers one day. We're chit-chatting, and I was complaining about the People's Republic of Idaho, and he asked me, do you have a Social Security number? And I said, well, of course I do. And he said, well, since you've got a Social Security number, then you're in a guardian ward relationship with the state. Why are you complaining about the states regulating you in a voluntary enterprise? That was a shocker to me. So what in the hell does Social Security have to do with capacity? And he said, well, you declared yourself to be incompetent and unable to manage your own personal affairs, and you've appointed government to take care of that, and that's why you have to pay them 16% of everything you create and produce. A little less than that back in those days, but today it's about 16%. To take care of you in your old age, to take care of you if you break your leg, to give you workman's compensation. Used to be in America, if you fell down, broke your leg, you'd take care of it yourself. Today you don't do that. Your employer has to take care of that. You're not competent. You can't handle things like that. So that's the way your freedoms have been eroded. Now, people will complain to me about the freedoms to keep and bear arms being eroded. There's not a single one's been eroded. Not a one. Now, there's 25,000 laws on the books. That was a shocker to me when I heard that there was 25,000 gun regulations. But hell, you've got 2,000 regulations in your state concerning driving an automobile. And you have a constitutional right to travel. You just don't have a constitutional right to travel in commerce by automobile. That's all. You still have a right to get a horse and buggy or walk or take a bicycle or, you know, travel some way like that. But anytime you enter into a Hale versus Hinkle enterprise like Delta Airlines or the White Star Steamship Company or Greyhound Bus Lines or something like that, or Amtrak, you're going to be regulated and controlled. And the fact that government didn't do it in the past doesn't mean they can't do it today or in the future. I showed you that in Hale. All right, now keep in mind that the Ninth Circuit ruled correctly, told us the answer. The three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the conviction of a man who had a machine gun. But the difference is he didn't buy this Uzi machine gun. He made the machine gun himself in his own basement, in his own machine shop. The gun was never in interstate commerce. Automobiles, when you buy one, you buy a new car from your local Ford dealer, that thing was made in Michigan or someplace else and shipped across state lines, and it's regulated and controlled. In fact, it's owned by the state, as evidenced by the fact that you're carrying a license plate on the front and back of it. All right, so that's a story up to the moment. Now, let me give you another little story here called Almeida Sanchez. This is an eye-opener here as it relates to this thing called rights. I'll just tell you a little background over here. Almeida Sanchez is 30 miles north of the Mexican border, traveling in an east-west highway or on an east-west highway, 30 miles north of the border at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And when he goes through an intersection that's got a lot of lights on it, a couple of Border Patrol agents can see that Sanchez is a Mexican driving a pickup at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the one guy says to the other, God, he must be a wetback. He must be an illegal alien. There must be something wrong with him because he's Mexican. Well, as the court pointed out later when this thing went to the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, there's about 30 million Mexicans down there in the southwestern United States. And to zero in on this guy and say, well, he's a Mexican, he must be a criminal, is a profiling, unconstitutional procedure that we're not going to allow. So they went out and they arrested the guy and they searched his pickup, and they found that it was full of marijuana. And so they prosecuted him for marijuana, and the case went on up to the Supreme Court. And so here's the story. In seeking a rationale for the validity of the search in this case, the government thus understandably sidesteps the automobile search cases. Instead, the government relies heavily on cases dealing with administrative inspections, but these cases fail to support the constitutionality of the search. In Camera versus Municipal Court, cited at 387 U.S. 523, the court held that administrative inspections to enforce community health and welfare regulations could be made on less than probable cause to believe that particular dwellings were the sites of particular violations. Yet the court insisted that the inspector obtain either a consent or a search warrant supported by particular physical and demographic characteristics of the areas to be searched. The search in the present case was conducted in the unfettered discretion of the members of the Border Patrol, who did not have a warrant, probable cause, or consent. This search thus embodied precisely the evil that the court saw in Camera when it insisted that the discretion of the official in the field be circumscribed by obtaining a warrant prior to the inspection. Two other administrative inspection cases relied upon by the government are equally in opposite. Colonnade Catering Corporation versus United States, cited at 397 U.S. 72, and United States versus Biswell, 406 U.S. 311, both approved warrantless searches and inspections of commercial enterprises engaged in businesses closely regulated and licensed by the government. Did you catch that? Businesses that are closely regulated and licensed by the government. Let me pause here for a moment and make a comment. The manufacture and sale of guns and ammunition is a closely regulated enterprise which is licensed by government. Any time that you and I enter into that kind of a business relationship, we buy an automobile from Ford, or we buy a Winchester from Walmart. That is you and I, voluntarily walk in and subject ourselves to these regulations and licensing laws and rules and customs usages and practices. Voluntarily. Now, in Colonnade, the court stressed the long history of federal regulation and taxation of the manufacture and sale of liquor, 397 U.S. at 76 and 77. In Biswell, the court noted the pervasive system of regulation and reporting imposed on licensed gun dealers at 406 U.S. 312 on pages 315 and 316. Now, a central difference between those cases and this case, Almeida Sanchez, is that businessmen engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade, whereas the petitioner here, Almeida Sanchez, was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. The businessman in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions placed upon him, as the court stated in Biswell. All right, now, let's back up here for a second. We got 25,000 laws, rules, and regulations that regulate guns. Listen, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms are federally regulated enterprises. I'm going to show you that when we get to Charles Wolf Packing Company here in just a minute. But alcohol, tobacco, and firearms are regulated enterprises. Now, you go down here and buy a package of cigarettes. You go down here and buy a bottle of whiskey. Government doesn't produce whiskey and cigarettes, but they tax them. In fact, when you pay $10 for a bottle of whiskey, it costs you $7.50 for the tax, and $2.50 goes to the manufacturer and the sale of the product. Government gets three times more out of that product than do all of the other people connected with it. Same thing is true with guns and tobacco, alcohol. Anytime government gets involved, it gets to be expensive and it gets to be regulated. It's always been that way. I showed you that when we got to Hale versus Henkel. And I'll show you that in greater detail in Wolf Company versus Industrial Court. I mentioned that last time. We'll cover it this time. But notice here, a central difference between those cases and this one is that businessmen engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade, whereas this petitioner, Almeida Sanchez, was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. Hauling marijuana at 3 o'clock in the morning is not a licensed enterprise, boys and girls. Buying, selling, and trading guns is. Now, that doesn't mean that guns can't be private. Antique firearms are private property, not regulated or controlled by the government. But firearms are. And that's the central difference. And there was a long evolution between guns, that is, property in guns. And then slowly but surely these corporations developed, you know, like the Winchester and Remington Corporation. And now they're in a different category. Different category. So if you want to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment, you got to go back to property and private rights. You cannot engage in franchise and corporate capacity. That's the bottom line to that story. All right, now we've covered the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals making a machine gun in your basement. That's private property. We talked about Hale versus Henkel. Individuals have private rights. Corporations do not. So, we've now separated out the Commerce Clause from your Bill of Rights. Now, let's take a look at an obscure old-timey case called Charles Wolf Packing Company versus the Court of Industrial Relations of the State of Kansas, decided back in 1922, and it's cited at 262 U.S. 522. And it deals with trade, commerce, business, and industry, which affects a public interest. All right, it says, businessmen said to be clothed with a public interest justifying some public regulation may be divided into three classes. So there are three classes of businesses that are regulated and controlled by government. And then there's a fourth class of business over here called private business, which isn't regulated or controlled at all, as we saw with individuals in Hale versus Henkel. Individuals have rights. Corporations have franchises and privileges. Now, Americans, starting about 1900, just to give us a reference point, starting about 1900, have abandoned your common law rights, and you have now gone into commercial privileges. Americans in 1900 did not run down and get a business license to conduct their business. And indeed, I'm operating a business that's not licensed. I operate a private law school. If I operated a public law school, I'd be regulated and controlled privately, private property, private business, private rights. We can do without licenses or government regulation. It means we have to be competent. We have to practice strict liability. I have to be responsible for my own actions. No limited liability here. All right, now there's three classifications. Here's what they are. A, those which are carried on under authority of a public grant of privileges expressly or impliedly imposing the affirmative duty of rendering public service demanded by any member of the public. For example, the business of a common carrier or a public utility. So if we're going to operate, you know, Citizens Utilities Company or Garrett Freight Lines in trade, commerce, business, and industry, then we're going to be regulated and controlled. All right, now the second one over here is certain occupations regarded as exceptional, the public interest attaching to which, recognized from earliest times, has survived the period of arbitrary regulation of all trades and callings by Parliament or colonial legislatures, such as inns, cabs, and grist mills. So if you're going to operate a yellow cab, a Holiday Inn, or you're going to have a public grist mill, a grist mill would be something that the public goes to, you know, like a Walmart store or a Denny's restaurant. Well, then you're going to have to be licensed, regulated, and controlled. Comes under the Commerce Clause again. We're not dealing with rights here. We're dealing with privileges and franchises. We're dealing with commerce. In the Bible, it's called Canaanite trafficking. If you're going to be a Canaanite trafficker and you're not going to deal in thou shalt not steal, well, then you're going to be regulated and controlled. That's what stocks and bonds and the Securities and Exchange Commission are all about. And then C, other businesses which have come to have such a peculiar relation to the public that government regulation has been superimposed upon them, where the owner, by devoting his business to the public use, in effect, grants the public an interest in that use, and then subjects himself to regulation to the extent of such interest. So I operate a private law school. Now, if I go up on the highway here and I put a billboard up, or I put an ad in the Yellow Pages, and I say, Gordon's Law School, come to school, we take Visa and MasterCard, then I open my business up to the public and the state comes in and regulates me to the extent that I use that business in commerce. So I don't have any advertising. I don't have a billboard. I don't use the Yellow Pages. I don't advertise on radio and TV. It's private, by contract only. Protected at Article 1, Section 10. Government is prohibited from impairing the obligation of our contract. All right, now, if you want to go out here and do business with Winchester and Remington at Walmart, you bring yourself into the regulations, all 25,000 of them. Now, if you want to buy an antique firearm, you want to deal in private property, and you want to stay out of commerce, well, now you can do that. And if you're one of these nine categories of person, even these nine categories of person still have their Second Amendment rights. They don't have any commercial privileges. Their commercial privileges have been lifted from them. Just like the judge takes your driver's license, he takes your commercial privilege away from you. There's nothing wrong with that. Government cannot take your rights away from you without due process of law. They can take your franchise, your license, or your privilege away from you at any time they want for any cause or reason. They could add to this list of nine prohibited categories of persons and put on there deadbeat dads. If you don't pay your child support, we're going to take away your right to keep and bear arms. We're going to take away your commercial franchise privileges of buying guns or holding a gun. So what it boils down to is that all the guns manufactured after 1898 are in commerce. Well, except those that you make yourself or that a gunsmith makes or something like that. It's got to be private. I mean, that's where that's just where the story begins and ends. That's what the law is all about. All right, hang on. We got to take a little break here and give you a couple of reminders, and then we'll be back with more on antique firearms. Legal firearms for prohibited persons when we come back. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and around the world over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. So this series of programs, if you want to take them, you can download them right off the Internet free of charge. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station, but I think they should. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about firearms, legal firearms for prohibited persons, the Second Amendment. I get a lot of calls here about the Second Amendment. And let me share with you the source of the information in this week's series is from the Anti-Shyster magazine. It's called Anti-Shyster, A-N-T-I-S-H-Y-S-T-E-R. And their webpage is www.antishyster.com, www.antishyster.com. This is volume 9, number 1. Volume 9, number 1. About 1999, I put this on the air some years back and thought, well, maybe it's time to do it again. All right, when we took our halfway break there, we're talking about Wolf Company versus Industrial Court. Now, there are three classifications that are regulated and controlled. Three classifications of public businesses, or a way for you to get into public business, that are regulated and controlled by government. They have to be licensed, bonded, and insured. Now, the fourth is called the option to deal or abstain from dealing, usually distinguishes private from quasi-public occupations. So let me just use our school here as an example. This school is not open to the public, and we advertise that very, very plainly. The law school is not open to the public. It is by private invitation only, and by contract. And we don't want government regulation and control, and we don't want the government's franchise, privilege, or permission. And we don't want the attendant regulation that goes along with it. And so we have to operate privately. In other words, it's kind of like this story here. I've mentioned this before. Let's try it again. Let's suppose that I want to do some business. You and I are walking down the street one day. And we say, well, gee, look at all those people over there behind that fence. And I say to you, well, yeah, that's the Napa State Hospital. But look at all those people in there. So we walk over to the fence, and we say, hey, any of you people interested in smoking Marlboro cigarettes? And a bunch of people come over, and they say, well, God, yeah, we'd like to buy some Marlboro cigarettes. And they happen to have some money, and they're passing money through the fence, and we're passing cigarettes. And God, business is just doing great. And pretty soon, a guard comes over. And he says, what are you guys doing? And we say, well, why don't you butt out of our private business? We are here doing business, and it's none of your business what we're doing. Now, these are mental patients in a mental hospital. They're in a guardian ward relationship between the state of California and them. They were feeling bad one day, and so they walked in. They said, well, I'm not feeling too good, and they signed themselves in voluntarily into the mental hospital. Now they're mental patients in the hospital. They have guardians. And you and I are over here trying to sell these wards of the state cigarettes through the fence. Don't you think that the state is going to say, wait a minute, these people are mentally incompetent. These people can't determine for themselves whether they should smoke or not smoke, whether smoking's good for them or bad for them, or whether it causes cancer or doesn't. We have to regulate and control all of that. Now, you know, when I use that example, people say, well, yeah, we could understand that with mental patients in a hospital, but see, I'm an American citizen. I'm not a mental patient. I'm not incompetent. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a second. Hang on. Are you really sure? So I went over to American Jurisprudence, second edition, and I just took a look here at the guardian ward relationship in volume 39, section 1, where it says guardian ward definition and nature. A guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character. I underlined the word sacred, sound kind of religious to me, in which one person called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. So a ward is somebody who's incapable of managing his own affairs. Huh. Woo. A guardian is somebody who manages the affairs of his ward because the ward is incapable of managing his own affairs. Guardian-ward relationship. A curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person. And in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. He has the same powers and obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that in effect he is a guardian of the estate, not the person. The purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the courts should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. So in a guardian-ward relationship, the guard at the mental hospital is an officer of the court. And there are statutes that regulate guardians and wards. And so inside the mental hospital, you know, you have to go first to the guardian and get the guardian's permission to sell those cigarettes to the inmates. Let's try it this way. Let's suppose you got a 15-year-old kid, and you're visiting here at the farm, and I see your kid, and I say, "Hey, kid, would you like a job?" And the kid says, "Well, yeah, I'd like a job." I say, "Well, listen, I got this thrashing machine over here, and I'd like you to thrash some grain. So I'll pay you a dollar a day to thrash grain in my thrasher." And the kid, he thinks that's a pretty good idea. And so you come to me a little while later and you say, "Hey, you see my kid?" And I say, "Yeah, he's over there thrashing grain." And he's doing what? "Yeah, he's over there thrashing grain. I hired him for a dollar a day." What would you think of that? Would you be so narrow-minded as to say, "Well, wait a minute, that's my kid over there, and you can't just hire my kid at a dollar a day? Why, that's slave labor. Why, that's unheard of, and I don't want my kid doing that." And I say, "Why don't you butt out? You know, he's free. He's white. He's 15 years old. But you see, the law doesn't recognize him as being free, white, and 21. He doesn't have rights. He's got some privileges and franchises." And that's where you are with minimum wage. You know, when you get a Social Security number, you can't work for a dollar a day. You got to have minimum wage. You've got to have deductions made and paid over to your guardian, the state. You have to wear steel-toed shoes and a hard hat and safety glasses. There's somebody that's going to come along and tell you when to get up, when to go to bed, and what to do in between. You know that. You have a job. You work out here in the workplace. There are laws that your guardian, the government, gives to your guardian, the employer. And so you have a superior guardian, an inferior guardian, and you're the ward, called an employee, working for some company. And you follow all of these instructions, and if you don't, you get punished. I can't come along here and interfere with your guardian-ward relationship. And here's why. In Section 22, in several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he's incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, he may request, or he may merely consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate or of his person or both his estate and his person, who, when appointed, possesses over the estate and the person substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. Incompetent. When you have a driver's license, you are a legal incompetent. When you have a marriage license, you are a legal incompetent. When you have a social security number, you're a legal incompetent. When you sign the admission contract in the hospital, you become a medical incompetent. When you hire an attorney, you give your power of attorney to your attorney, and you become a legal incompetent. And I didn't make these laws, boys and girls. I'm just here as a reporter to tell you where reality is located. Now, you go out here and you say, well, the government is a bunch of dirty, rotten SOBs because they're regulating my constitutional rights to keep and bear arms, and they won't let me have an M1 tank or hand grenades or fully automatic Uzi submachine guns. Well, of course they won't. You're already incompetent. You've declared yourself to be incompetent years ago when you got a social security number and a driver's license and a marriage license, for crying out loud. We already know that you're incompetent in those areas of your life. What in the hell would make you competent to handle a gun? Especially a modern firearm that fires cartridges with smokeless powder. I mean, after all, you people can't regulate and control yourselves with booze and broads at spring break, and you're shooting people off the street corners in Phoenix, Arizona. What in the hell makes you think that you're competent, huh? You know, our founding fathers had a lot to say about competence. They said, you know, if people want to be free, they have to be moral. That's why we had the Ten Commandments. You know, Americans used to teach and train their children with the Ten Commandments and teach them to read with the Bible. Well, today we threw the Bible out and we have immorality and teenage pregnancy, and that's why we have to have condoms in the public schools and sex education. Hell, you people can't teach your children about sex and reproduction. If you were competent and could do that, you wouldn't need public school sex education class, would you? You people can't educate your children. That's why you need public school. I don't deny that America is filled with incompetent persons who need guardians and need guidance and direction. That's why we have highway patrolmen out on the highways. You people are incompetent, can't handle these big, heavy automobiles, and you can't be responsible for your own actions. That's why you have to have insurance. And the insurance company is responsible for all the damages you cause out there on the road. You don't practice strict liability. What in the hell would make you think then, if you can't handle automobiles and you can't handle your own health, can't handle your own law and legal problems, what would make you think, what would make you believe that you're competent and capable of handling a dangerous item like a gun? So that's why we have a guardian-ward relationship, boys and girls. People with marriage licenses are of their own or by their own hand declaring themselves to be incompetent, unable to marry, manage marriage. So let me circle off guardian-ward. We've talked about the Commerce Clause. We've talked about licenses. You know, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal and lawful, a tort or a trespass, isn't it? All right, so we covered Almeida Sanchez, Hale versus Hinkle, the nine classes of prohibited persons. Now let's go back here to our story flow again. As we're talking about cartridge-firing guns. Now let's ascertain what is antique status. So if you want a gun that's exempt from the ATF regulations, you have to be certain that whatever gun you acquire is, in fact, an exempt antique. Now, if you go to a gun show, you may run across some shady gun show vendor, and they'll sometimes sell shotguns and then swear that they're antiques. Now, you go into court charged with possession of a gun, and then you say to the judge, well, you know, this guy told me it was an antique. That's the kind of incompetence that judges and prosecutors are there to protect the rest of society from. You better have a defense, don't you think? Nevertheless, you may later discover that a 1902 patent date stamped into the gun's barrel, which could subject you to serious problems should you be caught with it, and then the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent find out about it. So making sure that your gun is in fact an antique, which is exempt from, may take some research. And a good book to have is Flayderman's Guide to Antique American Firearms. That's spelled Flayderman, Guide to Antique American Firearms and Their Values. In its Smith & Wesson section, for example, it lists serial number runs along with manufacturing dates. For example, any .32 caliber Smith & Wesson double-action first model revolver made in 1880 only had serial numbers from 1 to 30. They only made 30 guns in 1880. The second model, made between 1880 and 1882, had serial numbers stamped 31 through 22,172. The third model, manufactured between 1882 and 1883, had serial numbers 22,173 through 43,405. Therefore, any Smith & Wesson 32 double-action revolver with a serial number of 43,405 or below is a legal antique, as it was made between 1880 and 1883. Now, another example would be the model 1898 Krag, U.S. military, 30 caliber, bolt action, magazine rifle made between 1898 and 1903 with serial numbers of 110,000 through 480,000. According to Flayderman's, serial numbers below 152,670 are considered antique under federal firearms law. Some guns have the manufacturer year stamped into the frames. For example, a model 1895 Mauser 7mm military bolt action magazine rifle. Now, any time that you're going to take an action, you need to be prepared. You should be thinking ahead and saying to yourself, gee, if this was to come to litigation, how would I defend this? What if I'm out duck hunting with my 1894 double barrel 12 gauge shotgun, and Ranger Rick comes over and he finds out that I'm a convicted felon from years past and arrests me, and then they charge me with a felon in possession of a firearm. How am I going to defend this? Well, shouldn't you have documentation? Shouldn't you research the statutes and the laws? Shouldn't you know and understand the law so that you can say, yeah, that's true, I'm out here duck hunting, and this is a 12-gauge shotgun, but I want you to notice that this 12-gauge shotgun has a serial number, and it's 1895. It's an antique, and it is exempt under the law, under 18 U.S. Code 921A16. It's not regulated or controlled. And after all, you're the guy that's going to have to make this argument. And what if you go hire an attorney? Or what if you take a public defender? And what if the public defender doesn't know the law? What if the public defender or your lawyer goes in and says, well, the only thing I could do is plead guilty for you, partner, because I don't know of this exception or exemption in the law. You know, that goes on all the time. Ignorant lawyers unable to defend their clients because they themselves are ignorant. So my common sense would tell me that if I was one of these nine prohibited classes of persons, and I said, gee, I'd like to go out here and have an antique firearm, a muzzleloader or something, am I the kind of guy that could have one of those? And so you go look up the law. Now, you might call the ATF guy, and he might say, well, no, you can't have a muzzleloader. Well, you can't even have a slingshot. Well, that's not true. I mean, you can have a butcher knife and you can have a 4,000-pound automobile and get licensed to drive and be one of those that kill 40,000 people a year, but you can't have a gun. Well, it's true, you can't have a firearm, but you can have an antique gun, which is property. So you've got two extremes here. You got the overzealous policeman who doesn't know the law, and then you may have an ignorant attorney who doesn't know the law either. So my common sense says you better know the law yourself. You better be able to go defend, or you better leave it alone. Now they go on to tell us here that other guns that have no serial numbers at all and therefore require further research. For example, if you wanted to buy an apparent but unconfirmed antique firearm from a gun shop, you could always put down a $20 deposit to hold the gun and then send a complete description of the firearm to ATF's Firearms Technology Branch and ask for a free classification decision. If the ATF classifies the gun as antique, then buy it. If not, don't. So the ATF itself has a service, and I've always recommended that you do this in tax matters. You know, if you've got some tax question, go down to the IRS and ask them. I mean, the guy may be ignorant and say, no, you can't take that deduction. Go to H&R Block. He may say, well, yes, you can take that deduction. You know? It's up to you. You're the guy that has to make this decision in the final analysis. You're going to sign that tax return. You're the guy that's going to be prosecuted for this illegal gun, you know, if in fact you're one of these nine people or nine classes of people. So if you want ATF knowing your business, for a fee, you can get an antiquity decision from any number of antique firearms experts. For example, for $20, Smith & Wesson will give you a letter stating the exact shipping date of any antique firearm made by them if you provide a description and a serial number. And then finally, if you buy a cartridge-firing antique firearm by mail order, you should feel secure that it really is a pre-1899 gun. Because unlike these fly-by-night gun show vendors, mail order gun dealers are closely watched to know that any mail order fraud will be quickly prosecuted by the ATF. All right, so now if you're going to buy from mail order, this is one of those licensed, bonded, and insured dealers. So he's got mail fraud. But you always want to make sure that you document it. Make sure that you've got a letter that you can show to the judge and say, wait a minute, he sold this gun to me and he assured me that this was an antique made before 1898 and that it wasn't a regulated firearm. That would be an affirmative defense. You relied in good faith upon a licensed paid professional would come under the Murdoch rule, 1932. It's called subjective good faith in tax matters. Anyway, that's another story for another day, but next time we'll take up ammunition, because this ammunition is regulated and controlled also. And you need to be careful that you're not handling a legal firearm, that is, an antique firearm, and then you have illegal ammunition. There's the two that go together. So you got legal and illegal ammunition, and you got legal and illegal firearms. And you have 25,000 of these firearms regulations that you have to comply with if, in fact, you're going to deal in commerce. So if you want to deal in these antique firearms, you got to know the law and you got to know it yourself. All right, I'm about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, right here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. The Law School teaches a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, there's the signal. Says time's up. I'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.